Disco, Volume 3, continued. Cassette 9, Side 1.
That same night it was announced that the liberal feeding policy was at an end, and that those who did not go out to work would be put on short rations. Camp Division Number 2 went to work in the morning. Number 3 didn't turn out for the third morning running. The jostling and shoving tactics were now applied to them, but with heavier forces. All the officers serving in Kengir, those who had come in to help, and those who were with investigating commissions, were mobilized. The officers picked a hut and entered in strength, dazzling the prisoners with the coming and going of white fur hats and the brilliance of their epaulettes, made their way, stooping among the bunks, and with no sign of distaste, sat down in their clean breeches on dirty pillows stuffed with shavings. "Come on, move up a bit. Can't you see I'm a lieutenant colonel?" The lieutenant colonel kept this up, shifting his seat with arms akimbo, until he shoved the owner of the mattress out into the passageway, where warders grabbed him by his sleeves and hustled him along to the work assignment area, or, if he was still too stubborn, into jail. The limited capacity of the two Kengir jails was a great nuisance to the staff. They held about 500 men. The strike was mastered, regardless of cost to the dignity and privileges of officers. This sacrifice was forced on them by the ambiguities of the time. They had no idea what was required of them, and mistakes could be dangerous. If they showed excessive zeal and shot down a crowd, they might end up as henchmen of Beria. But if they weren't zealous enough and didn't energetically push the strikers out to work, exactly the same thing could happen. Colonel Chechev, for one, was defeated by this conundrum. He retired after the February events, and we lose track of him, to discover him later living on his pension in Karaganda. We do not know how soon the camp commander, Colonel Yevzignyev, left Odzelag. An excellent manager, a modest comrade, he became deputy head of the Bratsk hydroelectric station. No hint of this in Yevtushenko's poem. Moreover, by their massive personal participation in putting down the strike, the MVD officers demonstrated as never before the importance of their epaulettes to the defense of holy order, the impossibility of reducing staffs, and their individual bravery. All previously proved methods were also employed. In March and April, several contingents of prisoners were transferred to other camps. The plague crept further. Some 70 men, Tenno among them, were sent to maximum security prisons with the classic formula, "All measures of correction exhausted, corrupts other prisoners, not suitable for labor camp." Lists of those dispatched to maximum security jails were posted in the camp to deter others. And to make the self-financing system, Gulag's new economic policy, as it were, a more satisfactory substitute for freedom and justice, a wide selection of foodstuffs was delivered to the previously ill-stocked sale points. They even, incredibly, started giving prisoners advances so that they could buy these provisions. Gulag giving the natives credit? Who had ever heard of such a thing? So for the second time in Kengir, a ripening abscess was launched before it could burst. But then the bosses went too far. They reached for the biggest stick they could use on the 58s, for the thieves. Why, indeed, should they dirty their hands and sully their epaulettes when they had the class allies? The bosses now renounced the whole principle of the special camps, acknowledged that if they segregated political prisoners, they had no means of making themselves understood, and just before the May Day celebrations brought in and distributed throughout the mutinous No. 3 camp division, 650 men, most of them thieves, some of them petty offenders, including many minors. "A healthy batch is joining us," the bosses spitefully warned the 58th. "Now you won't dare breathe," and they called on the new arrivals to "put our house in order." The bosses understood well enough how the restorers of order would begin, by stealing, by preying on others, and so setting every man against his fellows. And the bosses smiled the friendly smile which they reserved for such people when the thieves heard that there was a women's camp nearby and asked in their impudent beggar's whine for a "look at the women, boss man." But here again we see how unpredictable is the course of human emotions and of social movements. Injecting in Kangia number 3 a mammoth dose of tested ptomaine, the bosses obtained not a pacified camp, but the biggest mutiny in the history of the Gulag archipelago. Though they seem to be so scattered and so carefully sealed off, the islands of Gulag are linked by the transit prisons, so that they breathe the same air and the same vital fluids flow in their veins. Thus the massacre of stoolies, the hunger strikes, the disturbances in the special camps, had not remained unknown to the thieves. By 1954, so we are told, it was noticeable in transit prisons that the thieves came to respect the politicals. If this is so, what prevented us from gaining their respect earlier? All through the 20s, 30s and 40s, we blinkered Philistines, preoccupied as we were with our own importance to the world, with the contents of our duffel bags, with the shoes or trousers we had been allowed to retain, had conducted ourselves in the eyes of the thieves like characters on the comic stage. When they plundered our neighbours, intellectuals of world importance like ourselves, we shyly looked the other way and huddled together in our corners. And when the sub-men crossed the room to give us the treatment, we expected, of course, no help from neighbours, but obligingly surrendered all we had to these ugly customers in case they bit our heads off. Yes, our minds were busy elsewhere, and our hearts were trained for other things. We had never expected to meet an enemy so vile and so cruel. We, who were racked by the twists and turns of Russian history, were ready to die only in public, beautifully, with the whole world looking on, and only for the final salvation of all mankind. It might have been better if we had been far less clever. Perhaps when we first stepped into the cell of a transit prison, we should have been prepared, every man of us in the place, to take a knife between the ribs and slump in a wet corner on the slime around the latrine bucket, in a sordid brawl with those rat men whom the boys in blue had thrown in to gnaw our flesh. If we had, perhaps we should have suffered far fewer losses, found our courage sooner, and, who knows, shoulder to shoulder with these very same thieves, smashed Stalin's camps to smithereens. What reason, indeed, had the thieves to respect us? Well, then, when they arrived in Kangir, the thieves had already heard a thing or two. They came expecting to find a fighting spirit among the politicals. And before they could get their bearings and exchange doggy compliments with the camp authorities, their atamans were visited by some calm, broad-shouldered lads who sat down to talk about life and told them this: "We are representatives. You've heard all about the chopping in the special camps. Or if you haven't, we'll tell you. We can make knives as good as yours now. There are 600 of you, 2,600 of us. Think it over and take your choice. If you try squeezing us, we'll cut the lot of you up." Now, this was a wise step, if ever there was one, and long overdue, rounding on the thieves with everything they had, seeing them as the main enemy. Of course, nothing would have suited the boys in blue better than a free-for-all, but the thieves looked at the odds and saw that it wouldn't pay to take on the newly emboldened 58s 1-4. Their protectors, after all, were beyond the camp limits, and a fat lot of use anyway. What thief had ever respected them? Whereas the alliance which our lads offered was a novel and jolly adventure, which might also, they thought, clear a way over the fence into the women's camp. Their answer then was, "No, we're wiser than we used to be. We're with you, fellows." The conference has not been recorded for history, and the names of its participants are not preserved in protocols. This is a pity. They were clever lads. In their first huts, while they were still in the quarantine period, the healthy contingent held a housewarming party, making bonfires of their bunks and lockers on the cement floor and letting smoke pour through the windows. They expressed their disapproval of locks on hut doors by stuffing the keyholes with wood chips. For 2 weeks, the thieves behaved as though they were at a health resort. They reported for work, but all they did was sun themselves. The bosses, of course, would not dream of putting them on short rations, but for lack of funds could not pay wages to those of whom they had such bright hopes. Soon, however, vouchers turned up in the possession of the thieves, and they went to the stall to buy food. The bosses were heartened by this sign that the healthy element had begun thieving after all. But they were ill-informed. They were mistaken. A collection in aid of the thieves had been taken up among the politicals, also no doubt part of the compact, otherwise the thieves would not have been interested. And this was how they had come by their vouchers, an event too far out of the ordinary for the bosses to guess at it. No doubt the novelty and unfamiliarity of the game made it great fun for the criminals, especially the juveniles, treating fascists politely, not entering their sections without permission, not sitting down on their bunks without invitation. Paris, in the last century, took some of its criminals, it seems to have had plenty of them, into the militia, and called them the Mobile, a very apt description. They are such a mobile breed that they cannot rest quietly inside the shell of an ordinary humdrum existence, but inevitably break it. They had made it a rule not to steal, and it was unethical to slog away for the government, but they had to do something. The young cubs amused themselves by snatching off warders' caps, prancing over the hut roofs and over the high wall from Camp Division Number 3 to Number 2 during evening roll call, confusing the count, whistling, hooting, scaring the towers at night. They would have gone further and climbed into the women's camp if the service yard and its sentries had not been in the way. When disciplinary officers or education officers or security men looked in for a friendly chat with thieves in their hut, the juveniles hurt their feelings badly by pulling notebooks and purses out of their pockets, or suddenly leaning out from a top bunk and switching Godfather's cap peak backward. Gulag had never encountered such conduct, but then the whole situation was unprecedented. They had always in the past regarded their foster fathers in Gulag as fools, and the more earnestly those turkey cocks believed that they were successfully reforging the thieves, the more the thieves despised them. They were ready to burst with scornful laughter as they stepped onto a platform or before a microphone to talk about beginning a new life behind a wheelbarrow. But so far there had been no point in quarrelling with the bosses. Now, however, the compact with the politicals turned the newly released forces of the thieves against the bosses alone. Thus, the Gulag authorities, because they had only the mean intelligence of bureaucrats and lacked the higher intellectual powers of human beings, had themselves prepared the Kangir explosion, to begin with by the senseless shootings and then by pouring the thieves into the camp like petrol fumes into an overheated atmosphere. Events followed their inevitable course. It was impossible for the politicals not to offer the thieves a choice between war and alliance. It was impossible for the thieves to refuse an alliance, and it was impossible for the alliance, once concluded, to remain inactive. If it had, it would have fallen apart and civil war would have broken out. They had to start something, no matter what. And since those who start something are strung up, if they are 58s, with nooses around their necks, whereas if they are thieves, they are only mildly rebuked in their political discussion period, the thieves made the obvious suggestion, we'll start and you join in. It should be noted that the whole Kangir camp complex formed a single rectangle with one common outer fence and was subdivided across its width into separate camp areas. First came Camp Division Number 1, the women's camp, then the service yard. We have already talked about the industrial importance of its workshops. Then Number 2, then Number 3. And then the prison area, with its two jailhouses, an old and a new building, in which not only inmates of the camp, but free inhabitants of the settlement, were locked up from time to time. The obvious first objective was to capture the service yard, in which all the camp's food stores were also situated. They began the operation in the afternoon of a non-working day, Sunday, May the 16th, 1954. First, the Mobiles climbed onto the roofs of their huts and perched at intervals along the wall between Camp Divisions 2 and 3. Then, at the command of their leaders, who stayed up aloft, they jumped down into Camp Division Number 2 with sticks in their hands, formed up in a column, and marched in line along the central road. This ran along the axis of Number 2 right up to the inner gates of the service yard, which brought them to a halt. All these quite undisguised operations took a certain time, during which the warders managed to get themselves organized and obtain instructions. And here is something extremely interesting. The warders started running around to the huts of the 58s, appealing to these men whom they had treated like dirt for 35 years. "Look out, lads, the thieves are on their way to break into the women's camp. They're going to rape your wives and daughters. Come and help us. Let's stop them at it." But a treaty is a treaty, and those who, not knowing about it, seemed eager to follow the bosses, were stopped. Normally the 58s would have risen to this bait, but this time the warders found no helpers among them. Just how the warders would have defended the women's camp against their favourites, no one knows. But first they had to think of defending the storerooms around the service yard. The gates of the service yard were flung open, and a platoon of unarmed soldiers came out to meet the attackers, with Belyaev the wart leading them from behind. Perhaps devotion to duty had kept him inside the camp on a Sunday out of zeal, or perhaps he was officer of the day. The soldiers started pushing the mobiles away and broke their lines. Without resorting to their clubs, the thieves began retreating to their own camp division number 3, scaling the wall once again, from which the rear guard covered their retreat by throwing stones and mud bricks at the soldiers. No thief, of course, was arrested as a result of this. The authorities still saw it as nothing but high-spirited mischief, and let the camp Sunday quietly run its course. Dinner was handed around without incident, and in the evening, as soon as it was dark, they started showing a film, Rimsky-Korsakov, using a space near the mess hall as an open-air cinema. But before the gallant composer could withdraw from the conservatory and protest against oppression and persecution, the tinkle of broken glass could be heard from the lamps around the boundary zone. The mobiles were shooting at them from slingshots to put out the lights over the camp area. They swarmed all over Camp Division Number 2 in the darkness, and their shrill bandit whistles rent the air. They broke the service yard gate down with a beam, and from there made a breach in the wall with a section of railway line, and were through to the women's camp. There were also some of the younger 58s with them. In the light of the flares fired from the towers, our friend Captain Belyaev, the security officer, broke into the service yard from outside the camp, through the guardhouse with a platoon of Tommy gunners, and for the first time in the history of Gulag, opened fire on the class allies. Some were killed, and dozens wounded. Behind them came red tabs to bayonet the wounded. Behind them again, observing the usual division of punitive labor, already adopted in Ekibuestuts, in Norilsk, and in Vorkuta, ran warders with iron crowbars, and with these they battered the wounded to death. That night the lights went up in the operating room of the hospital in Camp Division Number 2, and Fuster, the surgeon, a Spanish prisoner, went to work. The service yard was now firmly held by the punitive forces, and machine gunners were posted there. But the 2nd Camp Division, the mobiles had played their overture, and the politicals now came onto the stage, erected a barricade facing the service yard gate. The 2nd and 3rd Camp Divisions had been joined together by a hole in the wall, and there were no longer any warders, any MVD authority in them. But what of those who had succeeded in breaking through to the women's camp and were now cut off there? Events outsoared the casual contempt which the thieves feel for females. When shots rang out in the service yard, those who had broken into the women's camp ceased to be greedy predators and became comrades in misfortune. The women hid them. Unarmed soldiers came in to catch them, then others with guns. The women got in the way of the searchers and resisted attempts to move them. The soldiers punched the women and struck them with their gun butts, dragged some of them off to jail, thanks to someone's foresight there was a jailhouse in the women's camp area, and shot at some of the men. Finding its punitive force under strength, the command brought into the women's camp some black tabs, soldiers from a construction battalion stationed in Kengir. But they would have nothing to do with this unsoldierly work, and had to be taken away. At the same time, here in the women's camp was the best political excuse which the executioners could offer their superiors in self-defense. They were not at all stupid. Whether they had read something of the sort or thought of it for themselves, On Monday, they let photographers into the women's camp, together with two or three of their own apes disguised as prisoners. The impostors started pulling women about while the photographers took pictures. Obviously, it was to save defenseless women from such bullying that Captain Belyaev had been compelled to open fire. In the morning hours on Monday, there was growing tension on both sides of the barricade and the broken gates to the service yard. The yard had not been cleared of bodies. Machine gunners lay at their guns, which were trained on the gate. In the liberated men's camps, they were breaking bunks to arm themselves and making shields out of boards and mattresses. Prisoners shouted across the barricade at the butchers, who shouted back. Something had to give. The position was far too precarious. The Zeks on the barricade were thinking of taking the offensive themselves. Some emaciated men took their shirts off, got up on the barricade, pointed to their bony chests and ribs, and shouted to the machine gunners, "Come on, then! Shoot! Strike down your fathers! Finish us off!" Suddenly, a soldier ran into the yard with a note for the officer. The officer gave orders for the bodies to be taken up, and the red tabs left the yard with them. For 5 minutes, the barricade was silent and mistrustful. Then the first Zeks peeped cautiously into the yard. It was empty, except for the black prison caps lying around, dead men's caps with stitched-on number patches. They discovered later that the order to clear the yard had been given by the Minister of Internal Affairs of the Kazakh Republic, who had just flown in from Alma-Ata. The bodies carried away were driven out onto the steppe and buried, to rule out post-mortem examination if someone later called for it. Shouts of "Hurrah!" went through the ranks, and they poured into the yard and on into the women's camp. They enlarged the breach. Then they freed the women in the jailhouse, and the whole camp was united. The whole of the main camp area was free. Only No. 4 Division, the camp jail, was left. There were four red-tabbed sentries on every tower, no lack of ears to cram with insults. Prisoners stood facing the towers and shouted at them, the women naturally louder than anyone, "You're worse than fascists, bloodsuckers, murderers!" A priest or two were, of course, easily found in the camp, and there in the morgue a requiem was sung for those who had been killed or died later from their wounds. How can we say what feelings wrung the hearts of those 8,000 men who for so long and until yesterday had been slaves with no sense of fellowship, and now had united and freed themselves, not fully perhaps, but at least within the rectangle of those walls and under the gaze of those quadrupled guards? Even the bedridden fast in locked huts at Ekibastuts was felt as a moment of contact with freedom. This now was the February Revolution, so long suppressed, the brotherhood of man had broken through at last. We loved the thieves, and the thieves loved us. There was no getting away from it. They had sealed the friendship in blood. They had departed from their code. Still more, of course, we loved the women, and now we were living as human beings should. There were women at our side once more, and they were our sisters and shared our fate. Proclamations appeared in the mess hall. "Arm yourselves as best you can, and attack the soldiers first." The most passionate among them hastily scrawled their slogans on scraps of newspaper. There was no other paper. In black or coloured letters. "Bash the Chekists, boys! Death to the Stoolies, the Chekers' stooges!" Here, there, everywhere you turn, there were meetings and orators. Everybody had suggestions of his own. "Come on, think. You're permitted to think now. Who gets your vote? What demand shall we put forward? What is it we want? Put Belyaev on trial. That's understood. Put the murderers on trial. Goes without saying. What else? No locking huts. Take the numbers off. But beyond that?" Beyond that came the most frightening thing, the real reason why they had started it all, what they really wanted. "We want freedom, of course. Just freedom. But who can give it to us? The judges who condemned us in Moscow. As long as our complaints are against Steplag or Karaganda, they will go on talking to us. But if we start complaining against Moscow, we'll all be buried in this steppe. Well then, what do we want? To break holes in the walls? To run off into the wilderness?" Those hours of freedom, immense chains had fallen from our arms and shoulders. No, whatever happened, there could be no regrets. That one day made it all worthwhile. Late on Monday, a delegation from Command HQ arrived in the seething camp. The delegation was quite well disposed. They did not glare savagely at the prisoners. They had no Tommy gunners with them. No one would ever take them for henchmen of the Bloody Barrier. Our side learned that generals had flown in from Moscow, Botchkov, from Gulag HQ, and the Deputy Procurator General Vavilov. They had served in Beria's time, but why reopen old wounds? They found the prisoners' demands fully justified. We simply gasped. Justified? We aren't rebels, then? No, no, they're quite justified. Those responsible for the shooting will be made to answer for it. But why did they beat up women? Beat up women? The delegation was shocked. That can't be true. Anya Mikhailovich brought in a succession of battered women for them to see. The commission was deeply moved. We'll look into it, never fear. Beasts! Lyuba Beshadskaya shouts at the general. There were other shouts. No locks on huts. We won't lock them any more. Take the numbers off. Certainly we'll take them off, comes the assurance from a general whom the prisoners had never laid eyes on and would never see again. The holes in the wall between camp areas must remain. They were getting bolder. We must be allowed to mix with each other. All right, mix as much as you like, the general agreed. Let the holes remain. Right, brothers, what else do we want? We've won, we've won. We raised hell for just one day, enjoyed ourselves, let off steam, and we won. Although some among us shake their heads and say, it's a trick, it's all a trick. We believe it. We believe our bosses, they're not so bad on the whole. We believe because that's our easiest way out of the situation. All that the downtrodden can do is go on hoping. After every disappointment, they must find fresh reason for hope. So on Tuesday, May the 18th, all the Kekengir camp divisions went out to work, reconciling themselves to thoughts of their dead. That morning, the whole affair could still have ended quietly, but the exalted generals assembled in Kengir would have considered such an outcome a defeat for themselves. They could not seriously admit that prisoners were in the right. They could not seriously punish soldiers of the MVD. Their mean understanding could draw only one moral. The walls between camp divisions were not strong enough. They must ring them with hoops of fire. And that day the zealous commanders harnessed for work people who had lost the habit years or decades ago. Officers and warders donned aprons. Those who knew how to handle them took up trowels. Soldiers released from the towers wheeled barrows and carried hods. Discharged soldiers who had stayed around the camps hauled and handed up mud bricks. And by evening, the breaches were bricked up. The broken lamps were replaced. Prohibited zones had been marked along inside walls, and sentries posted at the ends with orders to fire. When the columns of prisoners returned to camp in the evening after giving a day's work to the state, they were hurried into supper before they knew what was happening, so that they could be locked up quickly. On orders from the general, the jailers had to play for time that first evening, that evening of blatant dishonesty after yesterday's promises. Later on, the prisoners would get used to it and slip back into the rut. But before nightfall, the long-drawn whistles heard on Sunday shrilled through the camp again. The second and third camp divisions were calling to each other like hooligans on a spree. These whistles were another useful contribution from the thieves to the common cause. The warders took fright and fled from the campgrounds without finishing their duties. Only one officer slipped up. Medvedev, a first lieutenant in the quartermaster service, stayed behind to finish his business and was held prisoner till morning. The camp was in the hands of the Zeks, but they were divided. The towers opened fire with machine guns on anyone who approached the inside walls. They killed several and wounded several. Once again, Zeks broke all the lamps with slingshots, but the towers lit up the camp with flares. This was where the 2nd Camp Division found a use for the quartermaster. They tied him, with one of his epaulettes torn off, to a table, and pushed it up to the strip near the boundary fence, with him yelling to his people, "Don't shoot! It's me! This is me! Don't shoot!" They battered at the barbed wire and the new fence posts with long tables. But it was impossible under fire either to break through the barrier or to climb over it. So they had to burrow under. As always, there were no shovels, except those for use in case of fire, inside the camp. Kitchen knives and mess tins were put into service. That night, May the 18th to 19th, They burrowed under all the walls and again united all the divisions and the service yard. The towers had stopped shooting now, and there were plenty of tools in the service yard. The whole daytime work of the epauletted masons had gone to waste. Under cover of night, they broke down the boundary fences, knocked holes in the walls, and widened the passages, so that they would not become traps. In the next few days, they made them 20 meters wide. That same night, they broke through the wall around the 4th Camp Division, the prison area, too. The warders guarding the jails fled, some to the guardhouse, some to the towers, where ladders were let down for them. The prisoners wrecked the interrogation offices. Among those released from the jail were those who on the morrow would take command of the rising, former Red Army Colonel Kapiton Kuznetsov, a graduate of the Funza Academy, no longer young. After the war, he had commanded a regiment in Germany, and one of his men had run away to the western part. This was why he had been imprisoned. He was in the camp jail for slanderous accounts of camp life in letters sent out through free workers. And former First Lieutenant Gleb Sluchinkov, he had been a prisoner of war, and some said of Lasovite. In the new jailhouse were some inhabitants of the Kangir settlement, minor offenders. At first they thought that nationwide revolution had broken out and rejoiced in their unexpected freedom. But they quickly discovered that the revolution was too localized, and the minor offenders loyally returned to their stone sack and dutifully lived there without guards throughout the rebellion, though they did go to eat in the mutinous Zek's mess hall. Mutinous Zek's, who 3 times already had tried to reject this mutiny and this freedom. They did not know how to treat such gifts, and feared rather than desired them. But a force as relentless as the surf breaking on the shore had carried them helplessly into this rebellion. What else could they do? Put their faith in promises? They would be cheated again, as the slave masters had shown so clearly the day before, and so often in the past. Should they kneel in submission? They had spent years on their knees and earned no clemency. Should they give themselves up and take their punishment today? Today, or after a month of freedom, punishment would be equally cruel at the hands of those whose courts functioned like clockwork. If quarters were given out, it would be all around with no one left out. The runaway escapes to enjoy just 1 day of freedom. In just the same way, these 8,000 men had not so much raised a rebellion as escaped to freedom, though not for long. 8,000 men from being slaves had suddenly become free, and now was their chance to live. Faces, usually grim, softened into kind smiles. A hostile witness, Makiev, noted this. Women looked at men, and men took them by the hand. Some who had corresponded by ingenious secret ways without even seeing each other met at last. Lithuanian girls, whose weddings had been solemnized by priests on the other side of the wall, now saw their lawful wedded husbands for the first time. The Lord had sent down to earth the marriages made in heaven. For the first time in their lives, no one tried to prevent the sectarians and believers from meeting for prayer. Foreigners, scattered about the camp divisions, now found each other and talked about this strange Asiatic revolution in their own languages. The camp's food supply was in the hands of the prisoners. No one drove them out to work line-up and an 11-hour working day. The morning of May the 19th dawned over a feverishly sleepless camp which had torn off its number patches. Posts with broken lamps sprawled against the wire fences. Even without their help, the Zeks moved freely from zone to zone by the trenches dug under the wires. Many of them took their street clothes from the storerooms and put them on. Some of the lads crammed fur hats on their heads. Shortly there would be embroidered shirts, and on the Central Asians bright-coloured robes and turbans. The grey-black camp would be a blaze of colour. Orderlies went around the huts, summoning us to the big mess hall to elect a commission for negotiations with the authorities and for self-government, as it modestly and timidly described itself. For all they knew, they were electing it just for a few hours, but it was destined to become the government of Kangir Camp for 40 days. Had all this taken place 2 years earlier, if only for fear that he would find out, the bosses of Steplag would not have delayed a moment before giving the classic order, "Don't spare the bullets!" and shooting the whole crowd penned within these walls. If it had proved necessary to knock off 4,000 or all 8,000, they would not have felt the slightest tremor, because they were shockproof. But the complexity of the situation in 1954 made them vacillate. Even Vavilov, even Botchkov, sensed that a new breeze was stirring in Moscow. Quite a few prisoners had been shot in Kangir already, and they were still wondering how to make it look legal. So a delay was created, which meant time for the rebels to begin their new life of independence. In its very first hours, the political line of the revolt had to be determined, to be or not to be, should it follow in the wake of the simple-hearted messages scrawled over the columns of the robot press, "Bash the Czechists, boys"? As soon as he left the jail and began to take charge, whether through force of circumstances or because of his military skill, or on the advice of friends, or moved by some inner urge, Kapitan Ivanovich immediately adopted the line of those orthodox Soviet citizens who were not very numerous in Kangir and were usually pushed into the background. "Cut out all this scribbling of leaflets. Nip the evil of counter-revolution in the bud. Frustrate those who want to take advantage of events in our camp." These phrases I quote from notes kept by another member of the commission, A.F. Makayev, of an intimate discussion in Pyotr Akoyev's storeroom. The Orthodox citizens nodded approval of Kuznetsov. "Yes, if we don't stop those leaflets, we shall all get extra time." In the first hours, during the night, as he went around all the huts haranguing himself hoarse, again at the meeting in the mess hall next morning, and on many subsequent occasions, whenever he encountered extremist sentiments and the bitter rage of men whose lives were trodden so deep into the mire that they felt they had nothing more to lose, Kuznetsov endlessly, tirelessly repeated the same words. "Anti-Sovietism will be the death of us. If we display anti-Soviet slogans, we shall be crushed immediately. They're only waiting for an excuse to crush us. If we put out leaflets like that, they will be fully justified in shooting. Our salvation lies in loyalty. We must talk to Moscow's representatives in a manner befitting Soviet citizens." Then, in a louder voice, "We shall not permit such behavior on the part of a few provocateurs." However, while he was making these speeches, people on the bunks were loudly kissing. They didn't take in much of what he said. When a train carries you in the wrong direction and you decide to jump off, you have to jump with the motion of the train and not against it. The inertial force of history is just as hard to resist. By no means everyone wanted it that way, but the reasonableness of Kuznetsov's line was immediately perceived, and it prevailed. Very soon, slogans were hung up all over the camp in big letters easily legible from the towers and the guardhouse. "Long live the Soviet Constitution." "Long live the Presidium of the Central Committee." "Long live the Soviet regime." "The Central Committee must send one of its members and review our cases." "Down with the murdering Beriaites." "Wives of Steplag officers, aren't you ashamed to be the wives of murderers?" Although it was as clear as could be to the majority in Kangir that all the millions of acts of rough justice, near and distant, had taken place under the watery sun of that very constitution, and had been sanctioned by a Politburo consisting of the very same members, all they felt able to do was write, "Long live that constitution and that Politburo." As they reread their slogans, the rebel prisoners now felt themselves on firm legal ground and began to be less anxious. Their movement was not hopeless. Over the mess hall, where the elections had just taken place, a flag was raised, which the whole settlement could see. It hung there long afterward, white with a black border and the red Hospitaller's cross in the middle. In the International Maritime Code, this flag means "ship in distress, women and children on board." 12 men were elected to the commission, with Kuznetsov at their head. The members of the commission assumed individual responsibilities and created the following departments: Agitation and Propaganda, under the Lithuanian Knopkus, who had been sent for punishment from Norilsk after the rising there; Services and Maintenance; Food; Internal Security, Gleb Sluchenkov; Military, technical, perhaps the most remarkable branch of this camp government. Former Major Mikheyev was made responsible for contacts with the authorities. The commission also had among its members one of the atamans of the thieves, and he, too, was in charge of something. There were also some women, apparently Shaknovskaya, an economist and party member already grey, Suprun, an elderly teacher from the Carpathians, and Lyuma Bershadskaya. But did the real moving spirits behind the revolt join this commission? It seems that they did not. The centres, especially the Ukrainian centre, not more than a quarter of those in the whole camp were Russian, evidently kept themselves to themselves. Mikhail Keller, a Ukrainian partisan who from 1941 had fought alternately against the Germans and the Soviet side and had publicly axed a Stooley and Kengir, appeared at meetings of the commission as an observer from the other staff. The commission worked openly in the offices of the Women's Camp Division, but the military department moved its command post, field staff, out to the bathhouse in Camp Division No. 2. The departments set to work. The first few days were particularly hectic. There was so much planning and arranging to be done. First of all, they had to fortify their position. Mikheyev, in expectation of the inevitable military action to crush them, was against creating defences of any kind, but Surchenkov and Knopkus insisted. Great piles of mud bricks had risen, where the breaches in the inner walls were widened and cleared. They used these bricks to make barricades facing all the guard points, exits from within, entrances from without, which remained in the hands of the jailers, and any one of which might open at any minute to admit the punitive force. There were plenty of coils of barbed wire in the service yard. With this they made entanglements and scattered them about the threatened approaches. Nor did they omit to put out little boards saying, "Danger! Minefield!" This was one of the first of the technical department's bright ideas. The department's work was surrounded by great secrecy. In the occupied service yard, the technical department set aside secret premises with a skull and crossbones drawn on the door and the legend, "High tension, 100,000 volts. Only the handful of men who worked there were allowed in. So that even the prisoners did not get to know what the technical department's activities were. A rumour was very soon put about that it was making secret weapons of a chemical nature. Since both Zex and bosses knew very well what clever engineers there were in the camp, it was easy for a superstitious conviction to get around that they could do anything, even invent a weapon which no one had yet thought of in Moscow. As for making a few miserable mines, using the reagents which were there in the service yard, what was to stop them? So the boards saying minefield were taken seriously. Another weapon was devised, boxes of ground glass at the entrance to every hut, to throw in the eyes of the Tommy gunners. The teams were kept just as they had been, but were now called platoons, while the huts were called detachments, and detachment commanders were named, subordinate to the military department. Mikhail Keller was put in charge of all guard duties. Vulnerable places were occupied, according to a precise roster, by pickets, which were reinforced for the night hours. A man will not run away, and in general will show more courage in the presence of a woman. With this masculine psychological trait in mind, the rebels organized mixed pickets. Besides the many loud-mouthed women in Kengir, there proved to be many brave ones, especially among the Ukrainian girls, who were the majority in the women's camp. Without waiting this time for master's kind permission, they began taking the window bars down themselves. For the first 2 days, before the bosses thought of cutting the power supply to the camp, the lathes were still working in the shops, and they made a large number of pikes from these window bars by grinding down and sharpening their ends. The smiths and the lathe operators worked without a break in those first days, making weapons, knives, halberds and sabres, which were particularly popular with the thieves. They decorated the hilts with jingles and coloured leather. Others were seen with bludgeons in their hands. The pickets shouldered pikes as they went to take up their posts for the night. The women's platoon on their way at night to rooms provided in the men's camp, so that they could rush out to meet the attackers if the alarm was raised. It was naively assumed that the butchers would be ashamed to hurt women, also bristled with pikes. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette.